Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, and I'm your host. And today, our chef, this is going to be one of the most interesting chef stories we've had. Today's chef is, probably one of the chefs with the greatest challenge in America today. Jorge Collazo is the director of food for the New York City, the head chef for the New York City public school system. And what that means is the enrollment in the New York City schools is over a million. And they serve something like 156 million breakfasts a year in 1,600 schools and have a budget of $365 million. And the challenges are just incredible. And Jorge himself has been to the White House, has worked with Michelle Obama, and is considered one of the leaders in the movement to really try to make school food not only healthy, nutritious, but delicious and food that students want to eat. So Jorge, I'm just terribly excited to have you here today.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to jump into this. Hear about what you're doing and where the state of school food is today. But first, let me get into, how did you get into all of this? I understand you were born in Havana, which I was in last year. I loved it. What a beautiful city. A beautiful city.
I'm jealous.
So anyway, tell me where you grew up. How did you become a chef? What turned you on to food?
Well, I was born in Havana in 1950, and my family emigrated here in 1959. Sadly, I haven't been back, but I'm planning on a trip next year. How did I become a chef? Interesting story. Like any other chefs, it's could be kind of meandering.
Well, what were your first food memories? Did you grow up in a Cuban? Tell me about Cuban food.
Well, I mean, my earliest memories of food reside in my life in Cuba as a child. My mother's family, I lived for some time with my mother's family. We lived there. And, we had help. There was a cook for the family, and I remember wandering into that kitchen in the back of the house, and it's just these amazing women making like incredible food, and it was very early memory of that. And throughout my life, my mother, my aunts, everybody in my family were fantastic cooks. So,
did you cook with them? Or did you just eat?
I ate a lot, and but there's some sensory imprints that occur, irregardless whether you're physically active in the cooking or not.
I guess it
just started to seep into me.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you didn't go the chef route right away.
You
went the journalism.
Yeah, I was studying. I was studying journalism at Temple University in the mid-70s, and I was working in a family-owned restaurant in Philadelphia, Fisher's Seafood House, which was up on North Broad Street. And
was that for, because you needed a
money.
Job?
Yeah.
It wasn't because the love of...
Well, no, not really, not at all. I just needed to make some money.
Right.
Students, you do
absolutely.
Different things. So...
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first experience in a professional kitchen. And it wasn't glamorous. It was, you know, learning how to peel potatoes and all that. And I guess my first real challenge in the food, in that environment was when the one of the owners, well, the owner's son, you know, slapped down a whole salmon in front of me. And because I was cutting fish, they had showed me some rudimentary skills about butchering fish. And he said, "This is worth $100, you know, don't screw it up, you know." And that was
in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean,
$100 was $100.
I guess he was think it was a large one, and I don't know what the amount was, but it was a lot of money to me. It was impressive. So well, lo and behold, I didn't screw it up. So, but I don't know, the journalism career was I don't know. It was fine, the schooling, but I kept having this love affair, like growing kind of nurtured love affair with food business. And somebody said to me, "You should, if you really like this, you should go to cooking school. There's a school in upstate New York. It's called the CIA." I go, "What are you talking about?" And so I left Temple. I moved back to New Jersey. And at that time, you had to have a year's work experience before they allowed you in.
To the CIA.
Yeah, it's not that way anymore, I don't think, you know. And so I put myself, you know, to working in a restaurant. And I did, and I called them every day to see if there was a slot open, because no, but, you know, finally somebody decided not to attend. I said, "Yeah, Jorge, you have a." So I just immediately enrolled.
So before the year was up.
Yeah,
you were,
I mean,
so
I
anxious.
Was really calling them like a couple of times a week at least. You know, go.
So you got the bug.
I got the bug.
And so, did you love school?
Yes, I love school. Okay. I love being there. I loved everything about it. I love being with the chefs. I, at that time, you could live inside of the main monastery building. This was 1979. I graduated in 82.
Is that when Henry Barber was there?
I think so, yeah.
There was a
lot of
guy.
There was a lot of there's a lot of well-known chefs now that came out of those years, 82, 83, you know. So and I at that time you could live in the main, it was an old monastery.
Right.
Converted. And you know, at that time you could live in the main building, and I did, and I just spent all my time in the evening hanging out with Chef Banya and Chef Pepini, and just...
You were drinking the Kool-Aid.
I totally drank that Kool-Aid. I was excited.
So where did you go after school?
Well, I worked for a short time at... first, I worked for a short time at Vienna 79, which was...
Oh, that was a four-star, right?
Yeah.
New York Times four-star?
Yeah, four-star... Austrian, like upscale kind of Austrian restaurant.
David Boulay was there too. Were you there the same time?
No,
David,
there was two gentlemen there. Two young guys were there when I was there. So stayed there for a little while. And then I said, I want to try a hotel. So I went to the Helmsley because they were doing some really exciting food. You know, Chef Rene was there. And so... I stayed at the Helmsley working for Leona Helmsley for a year. So that was...
We won't go there.
That was quite an experience, I got to tell you. Yeah. Everyone has their Leona story, but...
Yeah. Well, I guess it steeled you for what was to come,
oh,
for your
word.
Challenges.
That was pretty interesting. And I don't know, you know, I found myself gravitating towards... you know, I thought about... There were so many people starting out at that time, but I was a little bit of an older student. I was 29 when I went to culinary school. So the idea of spending 100 hours, you know, I just went a different way. I had a lot of other interests. So a friend of mine, after the hotel, they said, you know, I work for this corporate caterer. I go, really? What's that all about? And They said, well, they have different accounts, you know. And I go, yeah, because I don't want to just, you know, I want to make great food. And so tell me about the hours. And I talked to this company and they said, well, we have this opening at a very, like, the most high-end account that we have, which is a law firm. I went, you know, and they said, okay, look, we'll try you out. They liked me. Mm-hmm. And so I stayed there. You know, I found that we made fantastic food for a lot of years. I just stayed there.
Yeah, they had a great budget, right?
Fabulous budget.
Yeah, that fabulous. Must have been fun.
Well, yeah, it was fun because it allowed me to do other things that I wanted to do, you know, on the weekend and stuff, you know, photography and things like that. So,
you play guitar too, don't
you? Now I do, yeah. I'm so excited.
Oh, really? When did you pick up guitar?
A couple of years ago.
Really? Good for you.
Actually, I've been noodling
around. You have a Fender guitar?
I have a Fender Telecaster guitar I'm in love with.
Wow.
And it's been a couple of years. A couple, 3 years I've been noodling. Now I have a serious teacher, and I'm really excited.
That's great. So,
but, yeah, I mean, you know, we had fabulous food at the law firm. It was great. So I was very happy.
So because you were cooking a long time before you came to the Board of Ed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So does anything prepare you for a job of the magnitude that you've taken on?
Well, you know, I guess when I interviewed for this current position, I was living in Vermont. I left that corporate dining gig and I moved to Vermont to become an instructor at the New England Culinary Institute, which I did.
So you had a calling for teaching.
Well, I had more of a calling to leave Jersey City and move to Vermont.
I see in and here there's some Buddhist studies, too.
Yeah,
that's, that up in Vermont?
A little bit. That's more current.
Okay.
But it wasn't so much a calling to teach as it was to have a completely different lifestyle, which, you know, I accomplished. So,
how long were you up there?
I lived in Vermont for 10 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
You must know your dairy.
We know dairy. I know how to stack wood, gardens. I had an old house with a barn. You know, I did the whole thing, burned the wood, everything, all that.
Wow.
You know, split wood, you know.
We're here at Roberta's. They split wood. I think, you know,
I'm good. I think I'll let them do that.
Yeah, right.
But so I stayed. I was an instructor there teaching. I created a curriculum for kind of a, it's like a food, culture, and religion class.
Really? Oh,
right.
That's
so that was, yeah, that was, it's there. They had something that existed, but I kind of totally blew it up. And
was the food and religion with dietary restrictions?
Yes. Yeah.
And
that was
why
part
they
of
came
it.
About?
That was part of it. There was, yes, there was a academic piece to the class, but then primarily, I had culinary students coming in, and we were doing menus, a Moroccan food, Thai food, French classical food, Mexican, things like that. So we would execute the recipes, talk about the food, and it was all skills based.
In a cultural sense,
right,
as well
so,
as a
yeah.
culinary sense.
So the kitchen component was all about skills development. But then afterwards, in the classroom piece, I gave them some sense of history, of Columbian Exchange, because that school, like any culinary school, you need a certain number of academic credits. So it fulfilled both the cooking skill, you know.
And
so,
it made it relevant. I think it's very hard to cook culturally without knowing the culture. You know,
without having some reference point to where their food came from, particular, you know, ethnicities or things like that. Yeah,
right.
That was great. So to answer your question about what prepared me, I guess I think primarily, I think what attracted them to my resume had a lot to do with the fact that I was in a corporate world. Mm-hmm. They interviewed a lot of restaurant chefs mm-hmm. for the position. Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing in a bureaucracy, mm-hmm. and you have to have some sense, it's really, you really need to have some sense of scale. Mm-hmm. Because when I was working for the corporate dining company, you know, I was one of the destination places where they would bring clients. So it more had to do with consistency across the company, you know, that kind of niche yes. of food that we required for other clients,
right.
similar clients. So consistency
and scale.
So we're gonna
take a yeah. break here okay. because now we're at the precipice here. We're gonna go over it when we come back. So okay. I'm talking to Jorge Collazo.
Thank you.
United States that has its own USDA inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. Full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, my guest is the head chef of the New York City school system, Jorge Collazo. Jorge, we were just talking, and now we want to get into it. These, you know, 860,000 kids that you've got.
Meals
that you have to serve, right. over a million kids.
Right.
How do you do it? What are the challenges? Everyone's talking about school food. I know you feel not only passionately about it,
right.
it's on your plate.
Right.
How do you do it? What are the real issues here?
The first thing you have to understand is the scale of this operation, which is, you kind of alluded to, it's immense. Just a few facts. So we have approximately 1,700 schools that are housed in probably 1,200 buildings, because we have campus schools now. We service all kinds of schools, charter schools, public schools, Catholic schools, all kinds of schools. Maybe I should explain a little bit about what my office does.
Yes.
Okay. So my department was created in 2005 for when I joined the system. And
how high are you up in the pecking order? Like between,
I have a boss. My boss is Stephen O'Brien. He's the director of food and food support.
Mm-hmm.
So food and food support, encompasses, my department, culinary concepts,
mm-hmm.
Supply chain management, which has to do and manages our commodity foods from the government. And also deals directly with our distributors.
So that's what you do?
No.
No, that's what he does?
No. He's in charge of essentially three departments.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Culinary concepts, which is mine.
Okay.
Supply chain management, which deals with the distributors.
Okay.
And managing our our commodity dollars mm-hmm. from the government, mm-hmm. and also the marketing department that we our in-house marketing department.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my department, mm-hmm. We write all the menus mm-hmm. for the New York City Department of Ed. We do all their R&D with companies to develop products mm-hmm. that meet New York City standards and federal guidelines, the new ones mm-hmm. in particular. We also do all the nutritional reviews of all the products, all the food. We maintain that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also I have 5 professional chefs that work for me.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have 7, but these 5 individuals, 3 of whom are CIA grads,
mm-hmm.
Their mission and daily work is they're each assigned to a borough. So what they do is skill development with cooks in schools and kitchen teams.
So you're also doing training.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. We do that to support. That was one of the first things I asked for when I joined the organization mm-hmm. was to hire a chef for every borough. Understanding from my experience in the corporate world about mm-hmm. how you. Push out the change.
I have, because this is a lot of professionals listen to this story. I think a lot of us want to know, is there a kitchen in these schools?
Yes.
Or are they just warming ovens?
No. There are a number of different profiles of kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
There are kitchens. There are ovens, convection ovens, steamers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are tilt skillets.
Mm-hmm.
Are they all equal? No, absolutely not. Okay. You've got buildings that are over 100 years old
mm-hmm.
and with the kitchens in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the, you know, this gets a little technical, but you asked. So as far as cooking is concerned, there are different profiles of kitchens depending on their fire suppression, what they are permitted to do and what they are not permitted to do.
So how does this enter into the mix? Does it make it much more complicated because you can't just do one thing if you have different kinds of kitchens across the board?
This is where we get to the point where you're starting to, as we say, having a nuanced conversation about art and science. You know, there's the art to this and there's a technical part to this. So, mm-hmm. When you look at, primarily speaking,
mm-hmm.
we are reheating food.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, when you consider that by the end of this year, probably every school building,
mm-hmm.
every kitchen, every cafeteria
mm-hmm.
will have a salad bar in it, which is something that was like the very first words out of my mouth
mm-hmm.
when... was salad bar.
You mean when you started?
Yeah, when I started, almost. Like, mm-hmm. that was one of the first things I uttered.
Okay.
And at now we are at a point, so...
Okay, so take me through that journey. Why did it take so long, 8 years, to get salad bars?
No, but there were salad bars.
But only in some schools.
Only in some schools. And they were not... They were not as robust, or mm-hmm. they did not have the same sort of profile that we have today.
Right.
So what happened over the course of 8 years?
Yeah.
Well, 8 years, you have to consider the narrative that's been going on and the conversation that's been going on in the public.
Yes.
That's been supported by... epidemiological kind of studies about obesity.
Right.
So as that conversation escalated in the mm-hmm. public eye,
yeah,
you know, the interest and the
support
and the you know, the resources
and the mechanics, I'm sure,
and the mechanics of it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just you can't have an idea and easily implement it. That's what I'm trying
to get through.
It does take time and
very
to
much
go
so.
Through.
There's a whole process and protocol, and we need to do that.
Yeah,
you
do the culinary concept. How free are you to make a menu? I mean, these guidelines from the federal government,
yes.
the guidelines from the city itself. I'm sure. What do you have to deal with when you're sitting down to make a menu?
Ah, my, you know, I don't know if any of my team is listening right now. I told them I was going to be on the radio, but right now, as we're speaking, I have, there's probably 7-8 people in my office writing and verifying the November menus for the school system. It is tremendously complex. It is very proscribed. I mean, we're talking sometimes 2 decimal places worth of grams of calories or fiber that we have to meet. You know, we have to.
And so there's a lot. Is that federal?
Yes, that's the new. That's the new standards. And when I say that it's very prescribed, that does not in any way mean that these changes are not welcome. Because I personally, I'm welcome on them. They are very welcome. People for years have been asking the USDA to make significant strides in the meal pattern and the nutrient profile of the food that is served in schools, and now they've done it through a lot of hard work by Michelle Obama. That whole kind of what she brought to that conversation was immense. As a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, through a stimulus grant, we were able to add over 100, 200 pieces of equipment to our kitchens, including over 100 salad bars through funds from the stimulus from the Obama administration. So there's like a whole, there's been a whole kind of, over these years that I've been there, when I first said we need to have better salad bars, or kids really like, kids like green stuff. And people said, I don't think that's true.
So are you allowed to buy anything you want if you have it in your budget? Can you have olive oil easily in the schools? Can you, you know, are you restricted?
Two-part question. So, like, when you ask me what do I have to do to meet the standards, it more has to do with, we're kind of asking manufacturers now to look when they consider presenting products to us. Obviously, cost, you cannot, there's a certain cost factor that after a certain point, product is unreachable to us. So, that being said, there are other ways to allocate your budgets. So, some of those other products become more accessible to you. But that's kind of complicated, but
so what kind of food are you going to see on the menu this year with the new parameters that you didn't see before?
Okay, well, it's kind of interesting. We are, it's more has to do with how we menu the items that we already have in our inventory. The R&D and bringing in more products that are minimally processed or completely whole muscle in terms of proteins, that's ongoing. That won't change. That's not changing. It more has to do how we menu what we already have to make them comply.
However, so the balance of protein,
it has to do, well, there's
complex carbohydrate, fiber.
There's the standards are written in a way where there are now maximum amounts of calories that you are allowed to offer per day and as a weekly average. There was always minimums that you had to meet, but never maximums that you had. You could not go over.
Well, what if a kid comes up 2 or 3 times?
They can't come 2 or 3 times.
I see. And so it's portioned out for them.
Absolutely.
And you didn't portion before?
Oh, of course. That's never changed.
But portions have changed. But the menu mix has to be a certain caloric.
The portions have increased in size. And also the profile of the nutrient density of the foods that you're allowed to offer has also changed. So in a very short period of time, there might be some remnants out there in some school, but white rice is no more. Okay, so grains have to be nutrient dense. Okay, and the portion sizes of those grains have to be at a certain level. So portion sizes have increased. This is causing, not only here in this city, but across the country, a lot of concern about cost. Because as I said before, everyone welcomes these changes. The issue is that basically they were unfunded. Now, if school districts are in compliance, They are offering school districts added reimbursement per meal.
Oh.
Okay.
Can we ask how much that is?
It's 6 cents per meal.
But when you've got
a million kids. Well, you there's a lot of documentation that has to be done, which is fine. We're compliant, and we're going to be compliant. And but the level of review has become much more intense. So it's kind of spend now. Hopefully, we'll get something back. Will it make up the difference in the amount? Probably not.
No, so we're going to have to unfortunately take another break. But I want to come back, and I guess it's a little confusing when you're saying you're putting more on the plate.
Yes.
And we're trying to get a maximum, you can't go over a maximum amount of calories. Let's kind of, we'll come back
we'll
explain
that. Yeah.
All right, you're listening to Chef Story.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Jorge Collazo, the head chef of the Board of Education for the City of New York. And we're talking about actually what the kids are going to eat this year with the new parameters. And Jorge, I'd like you to describe to me your vision of the perfect plate of food to give students. And how close are you to accomplishing that?
Okay. There are, we like to offer a whole host of choices to students. So I guess if maybe I could answer it in a sense of what would I like to see a student, how would I like to see a student's day go when they enter the school as far as it relates to what they choose to eat with us. So I would love to see students come to breakfast. Breakfast is offered at no cost to every student.
To the full million students?
Yeah, it's offered at no cost. That was something that Mayor Bloomberg did some years ago.
And what's for breakfast?
Well, you have, I'm very happy now that we were able to say that we just entered into an agreement and we are going to be offering Stonyfield organic yogurt. Great. For the first time. We're going to have organic yogurt on our menu, our breakfast menu citywide. We have scrambled eggs. You have, lean
oatmeal.
Yep, oatmeal. Different hot cereals. We're also very happy to be offering kashi this year.
Wow.
You know, two brands of kashi Kellogg cereal.
Mm-hmm.
So those,
so they're all good, healthy. Yeah. Do you have fresh fruit?
Fresh fruit every meal. We have fresh fruit.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's opportunity. That's what I'd love to see the student
come for breakfast.
Come for breakfast, okay. And then there are a number of different menu days that that I find personally attractive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that are a great day.
Okay, so it describes
like a roast. We have a roast chicken with Spanish rice made with a nutrient dense whole grain rice blend from a company called Whole Harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Legumes, let's say stewed black beans or pinto beans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the great things that has occurred in the with the new standards, is that they have called out that legumes should be offered once a week as a vegetable. Mm-hmm. Also, it's very color oriented, like red, mm-hmm. orange. Mm-hmm. We have a new sweet potato product that we're very happy about. So I would say a roast chicken, a day with roasted chicken, mm-hmm. You know, Spanish rice, some beans, some legumes, some black beans.
Has the new tech? Do you use the new technology of the vacuum packing and or water circulation? Is the new technology going to help in maybe getting more flavorful foods?
We are. So that's again part of the conversation between. No, we're not doing sous vide.
Okay.
Food in schools. Right. Okay.
But that help a lot if Bill Gates came and said, "Hey, Jorge, how much money you want to make?"
We have products like that already. All right. So, and again, this is when we're going back to when we talked about reheating and cooking, and the idea here is that when you talk about food made by hand, mm-hmm. in many ways, right? Okay, we're reheating certain foods in ovens, mm-hmm. but at the same time, salad bars are all made by hand. Sandwiches are made by hand. Mm-hmm. These legume recipes are all done by hand. Mm-hmm. We have whole grain pasta. All our pasta is whole grain. Mm-hmm. We're cooking that. You know, we're you know,
boiling at each location.
Yeah,
it's being made by hand.
Right. So, in certain instances, there are challenges in certain schools. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, right now, I'm talking to a company about, and this is the nuance about. How do you make the change across all of these environments? So I'm talking to this company about, it's a whole grain pasta, Italian pasta, that is pre-cooked, mm-hmm. al dente, mm-hmm. but it comes frozen in bags in a case. Mm-hmm. So that's one instance where you could take the pasta, you know, put it in a pan, mm-hmm. you know, defrost it overnight properly, mm-hmm. put it in a pan, put some sauce over it, put it mm-hmm. in the oven, and finish the product. Mm-hmm. I have a company that is preparing this. We already serve this. It comes frozen. It's kind of a Mexican, kind of a southwestern spiced bean mix, mm-hmm. that comes frozen, already cooked. Mm-hmm. So you see, you have to kind of try and work around the system. And these companies can do this. Mm-hmm. So to make it accessible, so the delivery systems, mm-hmm. I think a lot of times people want to see everything, people chopping everything by hand. You know, that we're not a restaurant. We're, at the end of the day, we're an institutional food service outfit, mm-hmm. that has, in many cases, technical challenges, mm-hmm. cost challenges that we try and address. Our volume allows us to get very good pricing from companies. They mm-hmm. want to be associated with us. Mm-hmm. They recognize who we are. They take recipes that I help develop with them and mm-hmm. my team, mm-hmm. and go back to manufacturers. They go and sell it across the country, mm-hmm. because they know we are very strict about having it meet nutrient standards, but also have it designed so I can tell a cook in a school, okay, when you serve this volume of food onto that kid's tray, mm-hmm. they are getting X amount of protein, mm-hmm. and that could be for legumes as well. Mm-hmm. So those foods are designed that way. So
how do you handle, I know that there are over 100 languages spoken by students.
Right.
You know, they're from all different countries.
Right.
How do you take in all the dietary restrictions, the allergies, the religious restrictions?
We don't.
You don't. So they either bring their lunch or...
We don't. So that's a good question, because people like to know about... They like to know that about that, but we don't offer kosher food. We do, just because it's extremely difficult to make sure the kitchen is kosher.
Kosher, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we do. We are able to address concerns from... Muslim parents, mm-hmm. because there was a project that we conducted a couple of years ago in the Bronx with a couple of schools, a whole host of schools, and you know, Muslims can eat, they can eat fish, they can eat pizza, they can eat, it's not that the ingredients have to be kosher. What they would like to see is halal meat. Mm-hmm. Halal butchered meat, which mm-hmm. we don't have the ability to offer. I mean, mm-hmm. it's extremely expensive, mm-hmm. and it's conflicted. So mm-hmm. as far as conflicted in the sense that it's very costly, mm-hmm. but As far as addressing every religious, so if you have a child from Bhutan,
which there are in the system, and you're serving Mexican food that day, does someone have to sit them down and say, try it, because it's so different from what they're used to in their home? Do you find that you're educating the palates of all of this diverse population?
Well, we don't really, I mean, we don't have time to sit down and have a conversation
about it
with that child from Bhutan.
I'll
say this. I think that cultural diversity is alive and well and real and something that everybody is aware of and wants to address as far as their food choices and things like that. But you also have to think about kids as just being kids. And that at the end of the day, that kid might be Bhutan, he might be from Bhutan, but he might be hanging out and chilling with Puerto Rican kids and African American kids and just anybody. His friends could be from across the board. And, you know, when you're talking about, my office produces 26 menus, all of which have to be in compliance. So,
can we get some of those menus up on the website so people can see the diversity of what
they're
offering?
Yeah, they're on our school food. They're on the Department of Ed. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, I don't know if we can address with a menu every.
No.
I mean,
so
it's
tell
not
me, in the Chinese, like in Chinatown in New York, there's not going to be any white rice on that menu.
Yeah, that's an issue.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be hard.
I mean, truthfully speaking, if you really looked at the regulations, it's possible to offer it. Here's the challenge. It is possible to offer it. But when you're planning your menu centrally and doing a nutritional review centrally, and the verification to get the extra 6 cents has to be done, you know, from a central location. In other words, if you offered a certain number of grains over the course of the week, yes, there is a nuanced way to still offer white rice.
Okay.
However,
that
kind of level of maneuvering at this point, because it just started.
It just started.
Actually, September was a kind of a test month, but it's real now. So for us to address that particular concern at this time would be challenging.
So if I had a wand and said, Jorge, you can have 3 wishes.
Okay. 3?
3.
Wow, that's a nice wand.
Yeah, because I don't, you know, maybe you can't choose one over the other. What 3 things would you wish for that you think would make huge differences in not just in your own backyard with the Board of Ed, but across the country for school food?
I would say that the first thing would be that the school, the food service program in this country needs to be properly funded.
And how much would that take?
Oh, well, that's a tough question.
You might have some philanthropists out there.
We welcome philanthropy. We'll listen
to
them. But
per student, would you need $5 a day or $3 a day?
I'll put it this way. Right now, we have a dollar to spend per child.
$1 a day.
Right. Now, so to be completely, you know, fair about it, we have all these salad bars, and the reimbursement is continued to support that. We don't get any added reimbursement for salad bars. We get nothing for it. We put it out on our own.
So that's in that dollar.
It's included there. It can be complicated, but let's say for the sake of this conversation, yes, we are able to cover the cost of the dollar, of the salad bar, sorry. However, let's say I wanted to switch to all of the proteins, the meat proteins, to whole muscle meat every time, you know, that we offered it, that it would be a completely whole muscle meat product. Right now, it's on a rotation basis. We can't do that right now. Okay, mm-hmm. That's one thing.
And whole muscle means a piece of meat that you would recognize as opposed to...
In other words, we're going to have another couple of products from a company that looks like it's turkey. It struck me turkey is kind of has a pulled, beautiful product.
Yeah.
Pulled. No, you can make a Cuban sandwich out of it. You can make barbecue. You mm-hmm. can do a lot of different things mm-hmm. with it. Okay. That item is currently purchased. Okay. It's mm-hmm. at a certain cost.
Yeah.
Compared to the more classic traditional foods that you think about in school meals, you know, like chicken tenders, you know, yeah. which we have all that stuff, mm-hmm. you know.
So the wand, because we're winding down. We're going to have to go.
Sorry.
So this is your last hurrah. Get it out there. Maybe we'll find a philanthropist.
We need to have the program funded properly. I would say it would be great to have our kitchens redone, the mm-hmm. ones that need to be redone.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, you know, really have the conversation about food embedded in the curriculum. In
the classroom.
In the classroom. To have the connection so you can teach percentages by showing a child a nutrient label mm-hmm. on a can of soda
mm-hmm.
and tell, okay, a 12-ounce can of soda, mm-hmm. here's percentages. Well, what does that really mean in terms of teaspoons of sugar? So you can teach math.
Sounds like a good math class,
Yeah, it's a great math class. And it's also have
life
conversation
study.
About how you eat. How do you dine? How do you approach food? As a child, mm-hmm. you know, in other words, how do you sit down and respect food when you're sitting across the table from your fellow student, you know? So I think just finding a way to elevate children's perception of food and what it means to them
mm-hmm.
and what it, on a number of different levels.
But, right.
So.
Well, you know what? I think you are the chef in the country with the most challenging job, and I'm so happy you found some time to come here today and talk with us, and I feel like we've just, I don't even know if we scratched the surface, so maybe you can come back later in the year and we can get more deeply into this and have Jorge Collazo part one and part two.
I'd love that, to tell people about, you know, we got a great program, we've made tremendous strides over the years, we've got work to do, but I'm really proud of our people and the people that work in the kitchens, the mm-hmm. cooks, the ladies. That are out there,
yeah.
Absolutely. Shout out to them and everyone that works so hard in those kitchens to get kids a great meal. So.
Well, thank you. And
you're welcome.
Keep feeding those kids. And congratulations on the salad bars.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.